LL AM580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. 2008 is going to be the year of a historic presidential election in the United States. It's one that's captured not only the attention of more Americans than any other election in memory, but of people across the world. But will it be a fair election? Will the winner actually win? That'll be the topic we'll be talking about today with our guest, Mark Crispin Miller, an expert on voting and voting patterns and voting legitimacy. He'll be joining us today live for the full hour. But first, before we go to Mark Crispin Miller, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
In nearly 50 cities and towns across the country, on August 27th, media reform activists visited their representatives in their home district offices. They brought with them thousands of petitions calling on Congress to support the resolution of disapproval that would overturn the Federal Communications Commission's ruling to lift media ownership limits. Last December, the Republican majority at the FCC gutted ownership rules that had kept giant media companies from owning broadcast stations and newspapers in the same market. The Senate voted to reject the FCC's decision, but the House has yet to vote. Jim Haig, who lives in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley area, talked to a staffer for Charlie Dent, representative of the 15th District.
I sat down with one of his staffers who admitted that really this issue was not top of mind, that nobody from either side had really talked about this or brought this to their attention. I had described what consolidation could be happening in the Lehigh Valley as a result of this, that here in the Lehigh Valley, not unlike 99% of all other communities in the country, there are no competing daily papers, and there really are very few independently owned television stations out there. Under these proposed rules, this would be a new consolidation free-for-all zone.
Haig, a former community paper publisher who is now a consultant for the industry, is concerned about the quality and quantity of news. But he was able to shine a light on an aspect of consolidation that is rarely talked about and deepened Dent staffer's interest, its impact on the local economy.
When you actually can have a stranglehold on the advertising market, when you have the small mom and pops who are already struggling to compete advertising-wise vis-a-vis the big boxes or the chain restaurants, and now when they're up against a media Goliath that they can no longer afford to advertise in, that really resonated for him.
For more information on the Day of Action, or to contact your member of Congress about media consolidation, go to stopbigmedia.com.
In Davis, California, low-power FM station KDRT, or KDRT, has won its 18-month dispute with the FCC to remain on the air, despite a big commercial station's successful attempt to take over its frequency. A full-power radio station, KMJE, wanted to move closer to Sacramento from their location about 100 miles north of Davis. They filed a petition with the FCC for a new location just 2 miles from KDRT. This would mean that KMJE would displace KDRT at 101.5 on the FM dial. The FCC authorized LPFM service 8 years ago to encourage localism in radio, but incumbent broadcasters were against LPFMs. So the agency gave primary status to full-power stations, which makes the larger stations able to encroach on the LPFM stations. KDRT station manager Jeff Shaw says that, upon hearing the news, the all-volunteer staff swung into action to fight for their station.
We launched the Save Our Station campaign and got about 90 donations from folks, which helped us pay for legal fees to file letters of objection, but also to contact our representatives, who would at least put in a showing of inquiry at the FCC.
The letter of objection also had a list of more than 500 public affairs shows that KDRT had aired since its launch. As it happened, the FCC was in the middle of a rulemaking procedure that concerned the way LPFMs were handled.
What they're currently proposing to do is change some of the rules regarding the way full-power stations can move and knock off a low-power station, change the rules such that low-power stations could move to a previously unavailable channel, and that's exactly what they did for us. They granted us what's called a special temporary authority to operate on a channel that was previously unavailable.
As of September 23rd, KDRT will have a new home on 95.7 FM. The FCC waived a rule called the third adjacent channel rule, which states that low-power stations must operate on channels that are at least three channels away from full-power channels to avoid LPFM interference with the larger channels. But it has been proven in a study that LPFM stations, with their 100 watts of power, don't interfere with the larger broadcasters. There is legislation pending in Congress to change the third adjacent rule.
It's basically showing that there is really no interference on these spacing rules. It is just kind of a political battle going on regarding where low-power stations could be placed on the dial. And when push comes to shove, the FCC can find solutions for low-power stations, even in congested markets.
While KDIRT has found a way to stay on the air, other stations have not been so lucky. In North Georgia, WBFC-LP was displaced by a Chattanooga Clear Channel station in June. They are currently looking for a new home on the FM dial.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, September 7th, 2008, on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. And we're just 2 months out from a presidential election, which by all accounts will be a historic election in the United States. Yet should we be concerned about whether we will have a fair election, whether the votes will count? Today, our guest is an expert on the subject. Mark Crispin Miller has written widely on politics and society and media in particular, and has two new books that address this, or two recent books, Fooled Again, and the more recent Loser Take All. Mark Crispin Miller is professor of communication at New York University. It's a pleasure to have him joining us today from New York. Mark, are you there?
Yeah. Hi, Bob.
Thank you so much for agreeing to do this, Mark, and congratulations on the new book, or the new version of the new book.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on with you, Bob.
Yeah, well, let's get right at it. There's a lot of stuff I'd like to cover with you today, Mark, not just the elections directly and the issue of stolen elections directly, but as one who reads your blog widely, you really keep a close eye, I think, to the broader political culture, too, and an array of other issues, some related, some not.
Right, right.
But let's start in on Loser Take All and the election issue. For some of our listeners who might not have heard of you when you've been on the show in the past or may not be familiar with your work, Mark Miller, just briefly give, if you can, a synopsis of the arguments you've been making over the last, say, 5 years now.
Well, to put it in a nutshell, there is copious, specific evidence, especially by now, that the Bush regime has been engaging in massive election fraud systematically since 2000, that the last two presidential elections were stolen. That the 2004 election wasn't even as close as we think, and that they have also clearly rigged a number of congressional and gubernatorial elections nationwide, including Don Siegelman's contest for re-election in 2002 in Alabama, Max Cleland's senatorial re-election race in Georgia that same year, and crucially, what all this means is that the next election is by no means a sure thing and will not perhaps be decided on the basis of what people actually want or how they actually vote. So Loser Take All is a collection of 14 essays that I edited by a range of scholars, journalists, and activists, dealing with different aspects of this, let's call it what it is, this conspiracy, and also devotes a number of chapters to steps that the Bush regime has taken over the last few years precisely to try to steal this next presidential election as well. So it's and I want to put this as succinctly as I can, taking note of the fact that the implications are extremely devastating and particularly shattering to a lot of the ways in which we usually think about elections. You know, we often think, for example, well, there'll be you know, we got to worry about the smears that are coming from the Republican Party. We have to worry about Jerome Corsi's book, because obviously John Kerry lost last time because he was Swift voted. Well, that whole way of going at it may be a little bit beside the point, because there is every evidence that Kerry didn't lose and that he was, you know, actually deprived of a considerable margin. So,
Mark, let me interject right here.
Sure.
If I can. A lot of people say, okay, Florida, we know that even the official count now shows that Gore did win Florida, and the Supreme Court stopped him from taking what he had actually won in a legitimate election. Even with all the chicanery, the votes that finally did get through, he won a majority of those when they were finally recounted.
Right.
So most people will say, okay, we understand that there's no question there was a sleazeball operation in Florida and in 2000. In 2004, the argument goes, but wait a second, there didn't, granted Ohio was the state that gave the election to Bush, had Kerry won it, he would be president, but didn't Kerry lose by hundreds of thousands of votes there? I mean, how high was the graft there that you're talking about?
Well, actually, the official number of votes that Kerry supposedly lost by was just shy of 118,000. Let me just give you one example of the kind of evidence that's come to light since. A guy named Richard Hayes Phillips spent 3 years with a team of election integrity activists literally scrutinizing every paper ballot that was cast in 18 Ohio counties. And the result of that study, and they took 30,000 digital photographs of individual ballots, the result of that study is a book called Witness to a Crime that includes a CD so that you can actually pop it into your computer and look at hundreds and hundreds of examples of what they found. And what they found was thousands and thousands of ballots that had been manually altered. People had darkened the box next to Kerry Edwards, and someone, in every case, had covered that box with a little paper circle and then darkened the box next to Bush Cheney. Now, that alone accounts for, you know, at least an equal number, a number equal to the number that Kerry supposedly lost by. That doesn't even begin to take account of the widespread vote flipping that people witnessed on the machines as they tried to use them throughout the state, and incidentally, Bob, throughout 11 other states. It doesn't take account of what happened with the central vote tabulators that are actually owned by a family of prominent and extremely zealous pro-life extremists. It doesn't begin to take account of the effect of the deliberate undersupply of working voting machines in Democratic precincts only. So what we're talking about here is a vast menu of tactics that were used in order to alter the vote, to sway the vote count. So I don't think it's at all an exaggeration to surmise, on the basis of all these different tricks and so on, that Kerry may have actually won Ohio by well over 500,000 votes. Bobby Kennedy Jr. did a piece for Rolling Stone on Ohio a couple of years ago, and he, you know, interviewed everybody, interviewed Republicans, he examined the evidence. The article was carefully vetted by Rolling Stone's lawyers, and his conservative estimate at that time was that Kerry won by 350,000 votes. Now, since that piece came out, a lot of other stuff has come to light, and let me just add the most dramatic of all, and probably the biggest news that I will give you on the program today. There is a guy in D.C. named Stephen Spoonamore. It's spelled exactly the way it sounds, Spoonamore, whose revelations are now driving a major RICO lawsuit based in Ohio. This guy, first of all, is a lifelong conservative Republican. Second of all, this guy was working with the McCain campaign until several months ago when he saw what the McCain campaign actually has planned. And finally, Spoonamore is a noted expert on computer fraud. In fact, that's what he does for a living, is help companies and governments spot computer fraud. Now, although right-wing, Spoonamore is a very principled guy, And what he has done is basically decided to become a whistleblower, and he has named Karl Rove's IT guru, the guy who helped Rove do whatever Rove wanted done, a guy named Mike Connell, who helped the Bush campaign in Florida in 2000, who helped the Bush campaign immensely in Ohio in 2004, who helped the Republicans in Alabama in 2002, whose fingerprints are all over this stuff, whom Spoonamore knows personally. And Spoonamore, incidentally, has reams of documentary evidence to back up every claim. The fact is that it is all true. It is not conspiracy theory. It is not speculation. We know exactly who has done this and how they have done it. So we're really well past the point when we need to be sort of parsing numbers and putting together bits of circumstantial evidence. These guys have been promoting an agenda so extreme that they have had to rely on fraud and vote suppression in order even to come to power. They could never really win an election in this country. And although I think that Obama has a very good chance, primarily because a lot of the big money is in his corner. I mean, Fox News, amazingly enough, has now started attacking McCain's commercials, you know. Even though, you know, I think that much of Wall Street is in Obama's corner, we cannot in any sense count out the commitment and the zeal of the Bush machine, which is in fact in charge of McCain's campaign, and which has ample motivation not to give up power because, of course, you know, they've committed a lot of serious crimes. So, you know, between them and the Christianists who are all for this campaign, I think we have to be extremely attentive to the possibility that they may try to steal. Well, they will try to steal this race, and they could conceivably manage to do it.
Our guest today, Mark Crispin Miller. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mark Crispin Miller, author or editor of the new book, Loser Take All, and author of Fooled Again, professor of communication at New York University, joining us live today from New York. If you have a comment or question for Mark Crispin Miller, the phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Mark Crispin Miller, you just mentioned Stephen Spoonamore's lawsuit, and I sort of got tangled up in the details. Who's he suing, and where is this at right now?
Okay, he's the lead witness for a lawsuit that is just being launched within the last couple of weeks in Ohio. The lawyers are Cliff Arnebeck and Bob Vitrakis, which are names that a lot of election integrity people will recognize. And the plaintiffs in this suit are the same ones who were the plaintiffs in the post-election Ohio suit, you know, Jesse Jackson, League of Women Voters. But now the case will cease, and a new case has begun, which is driven by Spoonamore's revelations. And the defendants are, it's pretty shocking. It's not just the Republican Party. But it's also the Chamber of Commerce, which has been functioning as a very effective political arm of Karl Rove's operation. They have actually spent around $400 million illegally on front organizations nationwide in efforts to defeat the election of judges who have an insufficiently pro-business agenda. The defendants also include Big Tobacco, which has had a huge vested interest in going after legislators who've tried to get in their way in Mississippi, for example. And, you know, working along with these ruthless and very powerful business interests have been some extremely committed Christianists whose pro-life ideology explains everything they've been doing. In fact, it is hard to find a principal player within the actual machine of fixing the numbers, you know, who is not a pro-life zealot. In fact, Spoonamore tells us that Mike Connell, who was Karl Rove's IT guru, actually told him that he has been helping the Republicans to steal elections in order to save the babies. So it's a very weird and I think so far quite effective alliance of religious extremists and corporate interests. If people want to, you know, read up on what Spoonmore has said and see some new videos of him speaking. 2 years ago, by the way, I know this is a show called Media Matters, and Bob, I think you know that I got interested in this issue of election fraud on the basis of the media's total failure to pay attention to any of this. You know, you and I worked together for years on the sort of election reform front, and indeed that work led me to this work because it seems to me that of all the media's many treasonous failings in this country, probably the worst of all is its you know, really startling refusal ever to pay any attention, you know, to this particular issue. 2 years ago, Spoonmore gave an interview, an extensive interview, to one of the major TV network's news divisions. They never used any of it. People can watch that interview for themselves. If they go to a website, the address is rovecybergate.com. Just www.rovecybergate.com. This is run by the nonprofit Velvet Revolution, which is the entity that's basically in charge of this whole lawsuit. And since their aim is to depose Karl Rove and Mike Connell and Jack Abramoff and Bob Ney and all these guys who were basically the top perpetrators of election fraud, since their aim is to depose these guys within the next few weeks and get those depositions out there online, you know, in the public eye, Velvet Revolution is soliciting donations from people. And I urge them, therefore, when they visit rovecybergate.com, not just to read all there is to read there, because it there's so much eye-opening stuff, it'll just blow people's minds. But there's also, you know, a button for donations. People can actually contribute money to this. Now, this is a civil case, see, which means that Karl Rove and Bob Ney and Jack Abramoff and the rest of them can't get out of a deposition. We know from the Paula Jones, you know, episode, you can't just sort of blow off a civil deposition.
Or more importantly, the O.J. trial.
Yeah, the O.J. trial, exactly. The judge in the case happens to be a principled judge. You know, he cares about this, and he intends to follow the letter of the law. These are all good signs. Of course, the media has covered this almost not at all, even though this particular whistleblower, Stephen Spoonmore, who is probably the 10th or 11th whistleblower to come along, has unimpeachably conservative credentials. But that's the media for you.
Mark Kristen Miller, I want to let you know, I think you've set today the all-time Media Matters record for filling up the phone banks quickest. We've got several callers anxiously waiting to get to, and I do my best to get to all the callers today. So let's start right away by going to line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
Yeah, as a fellow professor of the humanities, I was very intrigued. I've just come back from overseas, and this election has me fascinated, to say the least. And this is the first time I've heard from someone who I clearly understand as being a legitimate researcher looking into these matters, hearing this sort of thing so clearly laid out, although I haven't read your work as of yet. So it's very exciting. The one thing I'm curious, a couple things, one of which you partially answered, I suppose, which is if we're in a constitutional crisis, which I think is fairly clear, given that, you know, I mean, we're this is not a democracy, in other words, that they're stealing elections. Right. And the 2004 part of this not surprised in a sense, but the amount of evidence does surprise me. For you as a professor, I'm curious, are people coming after you, number one, on campus at all at NYU or the U.S. government? Because this is the sort of thing that leads to, well, how should I say, violent activities and threats and so forth. I'm just curious whether you've had this experience, because I wouldn't be surprised. And secondly, how is it? I mean, how do you explain Is the media in on this, basically? I mean, understand it, you know?
That's a very good question. Well, first of all, as to the first question, the scarier question, I don't have any trouble at NYU. The government's not going to go after me. I think you're going to understand my explanation why. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is call somebody a professor on TV. Mm-hmm. And that's like calling them, you know, manure for brains.
Oh, right, yeah, the whole anti-intellectual.
Exactly. I mean, Bob has been, Bob, you were mentioned a couple of times by Rush Limbaugh as a wacko professor. I mean, that's the extent of it. I did O'Reilly's show once, and he consistently referred to me as professor. Oh. It's so easy to marginalize me that the only punishment I can honestly say I have suffered is that my books are never reviewed, nor am I ever interviewed on, say, you know, any NPR show, shows that I used to do routinely before I started working on this subject. I can't get any op-eds written.
What about the New York Times, for example? Do they just don't give it? I can't say it. They don't care?
Well, that's the second question. And I have heard several times from people that the word has come down that this is not a subject that's going to be tolerated.
Oh, I'm sure.
I've heard this about the New York Times. I've heard this about one of the networks. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, maybe that's true and maybe it isn't. Certainly, at the editorial level or at the level of producers, even though individual reporters have shown a real interest in this story, once they move a little bit up the food chain, this is not going to surprise Bob one bit. Mm-hmm. They encounter the usual, there's no evidence there, or we've looked at this, there's nothing to it, or this is conspiracy, you know, whatever rationales they want to use to shoot it down. And I think it has a great deal to do with the Democratic Party's, you know, militant uninterest in the story.
Now,
there are exceptions. There's Dennis Kucinich, whose articles of impeachment are absolutely first-rate indictments of this regime for election fraud. But, you know, aside from him and John Conyers to a certain extent and Robert Wexler, no, the Democrats won't go there. And it's, you know, this would take us into a much longer discussion. I know all the phones are lit up, but basically it's a combination of careerism, their own corruption, and I think a certain degree of denial. I've talked to Kerry about this personally. I talked to Jerry Nadler about this personally, and I can say with some confidence that this is something that they don't want to go near, that they can't even begin to wrap their minds around it. And for that, we have to go back to something like the Social Democrats in the 30s and look at the way they responded to Hitler to see something similar, a similar sort of blindness, a refusal, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's at work with the press, as well as, let's be honest, a really strong hostility to democracy on the part of the parent companies that own the media.
I mean,
you know, voting is just too left-wing. So even Obama, you know, when he gives his big speech at the convention, won't even mention Martin Luther King's name.
Yeah.
Refers to a young preacher who spoke 45 years ago. Neither he nor any of the journalists who extolled his candidacy on civil rights grounds afterward, Bob Herbert of the Times, Eugene Robinson of the Washington Post, none of them would mention the fact that the civil rights movement was about voting rights. That never came up. And there's some kind of strange shift that's taken place in the way we all think about our own recent history. But voting has got to be put back into people's minds, into the minds of the left, let me add, because, you know, it is fundamental. No matter how corrupt the political system is, if we don't have the franchise, if we can't vote our representatives in and out of office, however inadequate the choices may often be, then we're not going to make progress on any other front.
Is even Feingold a sellout on this? What's he like?
Feingold's mind is open on this.
Okay, that's what I
mind
thought.
Is open.
Let me thank you very much, caller, so we can get on to some other callers. Mark, before we do get back to the phone lines, I want to go after this Democratic issue a little bit more. I remember talking to someone I'm close to who has somewhat different political views than I often have after the 2000 election, and he was very unimpressed with arguments that Gore actually won. He said, look, you know, if Bush was able to seize it, more power to him. That's how politics is. You know, he simply knows how to play the game better. And I said, well, what if more people voted for Gore? And he said, doesn't matter. And, you know, it's just, this is America. That's politics. It's hardball sport. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, this person was, not unsympathetic to the current order. And I said, well, isn't that unfair to the people who invested a lot of money in Gore to be their president, who gave lots? And then he lied. Yeah, you've got a good point there. People who want to make a big investment in a candidate have a right for, you know, an open marketplace.
Yeah.
But that leads to my question, which is, you know, we're seeing now with a number of Democratic candidates, but certainly the Obama candidacy. I mean, there are lots of people, powerful people, giving a lot of money.
Yeah.
People who've enjoyed tremendous success in their lives, and none of them enjoy that success for being fools.
Right.
Why on earth would they be giving huge amounts of money and all this energy and turning a blind eye to something this important? I mean, this seems to be a contradiction.
Well, it does seem to be one, but I do think that, you know, the issue has been so successfully defined as a crackpot thing. You know, it's been classed with the 9/11 truth movement. Now, I think that movement raises a lot of really important questions. My point simply is that it has been so successfully stigmatized as insane that it's a good model to use for the way that the system has also cast the question of election fraud. When an issue has been so overwhelmingly defined as crazy, people who, you know, even though they're savvy, as you say, and they're certainly willing to put their money, you know, where their interests lie, they might not want to take the risk or even bother to spend too much time thinking about the possibility that the game is fixed at that level. I mean, that's an inadequate answer. There has been a great deal of attention paid by rich liberals to the problems of vote suppression. Okay, I take The Nation magazine to represent the rich liberal community. The Nation, as soon as Election Day 2004 was over, the issue of election fraud was off limits at The Nation, and they have never talked about it, and they refuse to talk about it. Over the last few months, however, they have begun to talk about vote suppression. See, these are two different things that the Republicans use together to fix elections. One is to prevent people from being able to vote, you know, preemptively by not enabling them to register and so on, or by, coming up with requirements at the polling places that people can't meet. The other is changing vote totals electronically after the fact or manually after the fact. That's fraud. Well, you know, I think it's a partial answer to your question to say that at least some of these problems have now been faced by rich people who are supporting Obama, you know. Without naming names, which I don't want to do, I can't get much more specific than that.
Okay.
It is my hope, though, that over the next couple of months, more of those people who are putting money on Obama will wake up to what's going down and will actually try to do something. But to understand this, Bob, the people who think exclusively in terms of their investments may be loath to embrace the kind of solution we really need to this problem, which is, of course, a democratic solution. That is to say, we have to tell the people of this country what's been going on so that the people of this country can push for reform and have some voice in what that reform would be, right? The people who think exclusively in terms of their investments may be disinclined to, you know, rouse the rabble in that way. So that, you know, maybe that's one explanation for why they're so, you know, indisposed to talk about this thing out loud. I don't really know.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest today, Mark Crispin Miller, professor at New York University, editor of the new book, Loser Take All, author of Fooled Again and countless other books on media and politics in the United States. Let's now go to line four, a cell phone in Rantoul. I hope we still have you. You're on there with Mark Miller.
Oh, yes, although thus far, I just don't know. I have a friend who very much believes, hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Who very much believes in the Trilateral Commission and the Illuminati.
Yeah.
And we sit down and have discussions, and it comes down to how far down it would have to go, I guess, and the fact that our government is seemingly, eventually pretty damn poor about keeping secrets.
Mm-hmm.
As far as this thing with the, we'll just, like, there was so many, I'll just call them nutball things your guest commented on. Voter fraud. I mean, you know, fixing an election. When you think about it, that has to go all the way down to individual polling places.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love to hear, because, I mean, you're talking about access. When I went to register to vote, I did it when I got my driver's license. When we go to vote here, they ask your name, and you sign, and they, you know, some 70-year-old woman who's been through the election judge process, I guess, sort of verifies your name's the same, and that's it. We don't require IDs. There's nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
But just one specific issue, I would love to hear the nuts and bolts from this gentleman of how it goes from the vote count at the youth center up the street here in Rantoul, you know, up to the top. At what point are a significant amount of those votes altered, which is what he's alleging, to make the other side win?
Thank you very much
for specifics.
Thank you very much, caller. Yeah, Mark, he wants some specifics, and if
no,
I can just
no, I'll give him specifics, but I actually haven't really alleged anything, and I've simply reported, and there is a difference. I have reported, for example, that another Republican and a lifelong conservative Republican named Stephen Spoonamore has verified that, for example, the central vote tabulators in Ohio were used to change the numerical results of elections in that state. That's a very, very simple thing to do, and it does not have to filter down to the polling place level. Now, certain strokes of election fraud do involve and have involved the participation of people at individual polling places, and I can give a very precise example. In Pima County, Arizona, in the 2004 election, there was indeed election fraud carried out between people who had, you know, basically been in charge of the machinery at the top and grassroots poll workers who all came from the same church in that precinct. The entire operation is described in exquisite detail in an essay in Loser Take All by an engineer named Dave Griscom, G-R-I-S-C-O-M. If my friend in Rantoul is sincerely interested in knowing the specifics of how that operated, he should get a hold of the book and read that essay. Otherwise, there are various kinds of election fraud that don't in any sense require the participation or awareness of poll workers. I mean, we've all used computers. We all, I think, by now should know that computer systems can be very, very efficiently and quickly hacked, and they can be hacked undetectably. So, for example, if you make a change in the memory cards of a computer network, you can fix it so that one out of every X votes in a particular county, for example, will be flipped from one candidate to another. And we know from various precincts in Ohio that something like one out of every 10 or 20 Democratic votes was flipped. People saw this happen with their own eyes. They would press the button for Kerry, and the button for Bush would light up. Now, if he wants specific evidence of this claim, all he has to do is go to the Election Incident Reporting System. That's just a Google search on EIRS. Type in, say, Ohio, and go through the complaints that people made. They phoned in. Bob, well over 90 or 95% of the complaints were from Democrats, you know, people who tried to vote for Democrats. The machine shortages only affected Democrats. Now, if you look at the evidence, you actually read the evidence, and so far I believe I've given you only verifiable evidence. See, you cannot turn around then and say that this is like talking about the Illuminati or the Trilateral Commission or the Martian conspiracy to kill Kennedy or whatever it is. I'm just as impatient with that kind of paranoia as anybody else. Anyone who knows me knows this is true. I don't even think Kennedy was murdered by a government conspiracy. I don't think there's a shred of evidence for that. I think the mafia did it. The fact is, that this whole argument of mine is based exclusively on the evidence and not on any kind of partisan bias, because I'm not a Democrat. Moreover, I wouldn't be a Democrat if you paid me primarily because of the Democratic Party's abject cowardice on this very issue. As far as I'm concerned, this is all about voting rights. And finally, let me add, there are a number of Republicans, not just Stephen Spoonamore, who have come forward, who have blown the whistle on this stuff. And a lot of people in Ron Paul's campaign will talk at great length and in detail about how his candidacy was robbed of countless votes throughout the recent primary season. So it cuts both ways. I don't think John McCain got as many votes as he is said to have gotten. Hillary Clinton did not get as many votes as she is said to have gotten. So, leaving aside all the slurs and the slanders and the derision about conspiracy theory, I think any responsible American who really believes in our founding ideals is obliged to look at the evidence and to do so with an open mind.
Our guest, Mark Christen Miller, I'm going to get back to the phone lines just in one second, but I want to clarify one point you just made.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've made an argument that you've been talking about behind the conspiracy is an element of the Republican Party, not the entire party, centered around Bush, Cheney, Karl Rove,
we've
come to call the neocons in sort of collaboration with the zealots and the far right. John McCain is running for president, really in opposition to them, at least rhetorically, based on the Republican convention. He's running as the reformer, as the agent of change. I don't get the sense you're buying that.
You know, you have to get up pretty early in the morning to fool you.
Okay, well, tell me what you think, then.
No, I don't. Of course he's not. But, this is uncharacteristic of me, but I'll, just use a line of Obama's. I mean, it is true that McCain voted with Bush over 90% of the time. And McCain is primarily ambitious. You know, he has very carefully crafted this image of himself as a maverick. But as one of his own ex-supporters has demonstrated in detail in this book, The Real McCain, that maverick pose is preposterous. He's not a maverick. He's an opportunist, like most politicians, and he wants, above all, to win. Now, why the Bush people chose to help him out, I don't precisely know. Maybe he has something on them, or God knows what. But the fact is that a lot of Rove's people are working with the McCain campaign right now. And, I don't really think that McCain could even conceivably win without some kind of fraud. And he will also, let me add, take, full advantage of the extensive vote suppression measures that the Bush regime has taken over the last few years. We haven't even really talked about that. But, for example, the Indiana photo ID law, requiring voters to come to the polls with state-issued photo IDs, the most stringent such law in the nation, was upheld recently by the Supreme Court. It has already demonstrably disenfranchised thousands of Indianans, and it is, let me add, based on a claim that is as crazy as any theory about the Illuminati, and that's the claim that such legislation is necessary to prevent an enormous surge of what they call voter fraud, which means people turning up at the polls and stuffing the ballot box, voting 12 times. Well, there is not one known case of voter fraud ever having been committed in the state of Indiana. I mean, the whole thing is a propaganda fiction whose purpose is precisely to legitimize the passage of Jim Crow laws whose aim is to narrow the franchise as much as possible on Election Day. John McCain will benefit from this. And, of course, if he really were this big maverick who really were trying to distance himself from the Bush machine and its constituents, he's got a very funny way of showing it if he picked Sarah Palin to be his vice presidential candidate. So,
on that note, let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest today on Media Matters, Mark Christen Miller, professor at New York University, expert on voting fraud and election irregularities. Let's go to line three now. Charleston, you're on the air.
Hello. Well, I guess you kind of preempted my question because I was just going to ask something about John McCain's awareness of this. But I'm just sitting here shaking. You know, I was really hopeful that maybe this time around we'd get to change, you know, all that old dirty trick stuff and have a real election and get a different person. And I feel really sad and betrayed and helpless and so on when I think that no matter what, you know, we're not going to be able by honest voting to change things there. But I watched both conventions and I just felt how absurd the whole thing was in the Republican convention of the Sarah Palin and all of that and stirring up all of the kind of gossip that they're saying they did not want and, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm seeing in the paper this morning that Sarah Palin is making statements of policy and referring to the McCain-Palin administration. So what I was going to ask, and I think you maybe already answered, was to what extent does John McCain really know that this kind of fraud is being used on his behalf and there's a conspiracy? I sometimes feel like he's just a kind of well-meaning old guy that's being duped, you know, the way he kind of stands back and lets this woman say her stuff and talk about the McCain-Palin administration and doesn't take it over himself, you know.
Yeah, well,
so I won't go on, and I'll just hang up and let you answer or
okay,
comment
in any way you want to.
Thank you, caller.
I appreciate that call. I mean, I'll say very quickly that I think John McCain is just yet another extremely ruthless politician, and there's no reason to suppose he's completely unaware of this sort of thing. Moreover, there are serious election problems in Arizona and have been for a long time. In fact, just yesterday, John Brakey, who is a very well-respected election reform activist, was arrested at a polling place where they were, you know, conducting the Arizona primary. And he was, you know, taken into custody because he was asking too many questions about how they were counting the votes. I can't believe that John McCain's not aware of stuff like that. But I want to speak more to the caller's initial statements about her feelings of helplessness and sadness and so on. That's actually the last thing I want people to feel, you know. Now, when you haven't been hearing about all this stuff, and most of us haven't because the press never reports it, I admit that to hear it all at once is kind of a staggering experience, you know, if you have an open mind. But, you know, once you get past that, once you begin to follow what's actually going on, once you begin to understand that this is a problem like the problem of media concentration, that's the result of policies, and that policies can be changed. And finally, and most importantly, once you understand that if you're depressed, it only means you're taking something out on yourself, see, then you can begin to feel a little bit better because you're going to make sure that, A, this doesn't happen again, and, B, more importantly, if it does, you're not going to tolerate it. You're not going to take it. You know, the important thing here is that people find out what's going on and tell other people about what's going on, you know. Now, a lot of the young Obama supporters are becoming more aware of this dimension of the challenge that faces their candidate. And in Nevada, for example, in the Nevada primary, the Clinton people committed all kinds of vote suppression. It was a kind of carnival of vote suppression. It was so egregious that the young Obama supporters pushed the campaign until finally Obama was forced to file a complaint with the Federal Election Commission. Of course, it got no coverage, but that's another issue. We have to grasp the importance of our own empowerment here through the gathering of information. It's a roundabout way of saying that once we find out what's going down, once we start to pay attention to it, once we acknowledge that it has been happening, and once we talk to each other about it, we're only going to feel less helpless and less victimized. Because here's the good news. You know, we have never elected these people you know? I mean, a lot of liberals have decided that people are just too stupid to vote their own self-interest. You know, they ask, what's the matter with Kansas? There's this presumption that people are basically barbarians, oafs, fools in this country, and they voted for Bush twice, and they vote for all these ultra-right-wing senators and so on. There is copious evidence that's simply not the case.
Mark, let me interrupt because I want to get to the last couple callers, but I also have one last question I want to make sure you do answer so that so there's no misconception with our listeners, especially that last caller. As I understand it, you're not the argument isn't that all 50 states are equal in fraudulent elections. Some states are far worse than others. Some don't have problems to speak of.
Exactly.
And so it's conceivable, for example, that Obama could win the presidential election because he could win enough states where there aren't problems that this would not be an issue. Or he could win some states sufficiently that even the monkeying around wouldn't be sufficient.
That's right. There are two points to make. One is this is not a, you know, like uniform across the nation. It is going to be a matter of certain states. And in fact, someone who must remain anonymous, who was with the Republicans, told the people running this lawsuit in Ohio that the McCain team plans to steal it in six states. We don't know what six they are, but we have some idea that they, you know, be Ohio, Michigan, Colorado, and a few others. So it's not, you know, depending on where you live, there's actually, I think, more than an even chance that your vote might be counted, okay? So it's not something that's like everywhere. Second of all, you know, to those who believe that, Obama should be president, I think that high turnout on Election Day is essential. The higher the turnout, the harder it is to explain away a kind of unlikely result. So I've always been a champion of as large as possible a turnout on Election Day, and that's what happened in 2006. You know, it's one of the reasons why the Democrats were able to win 29 House seats. Now, as one of the essays in Loser Takes All makes clear, the Democrats actually won more like 50 seats in 2006, but the Republicans did succeed in stealing around 20.
Mark, I'm going to stop you again, and I hate to do this because we could go for a Jerry Lewis telethon on this for the time, but we have several callers. I do want to give them an opportunity. Line one, Urbana, I thank you for your patience. You're on with Mark Crispin Miller.
A little hard to keep my thoughts organized over this length of time. I've acted as an election judge in Champaign County, and the system here and our machines are probably different from other counties. In Illinois, the county clerk chooses the voting machine system. We don't have the same kind that you were describing with an electronic button pushing. People fill in the dots themselves. It's counted on a machine that sits on top of the ballot box. The election judges double check or get a readout from that machine at the end of the closing and submit both that tabulation, the paper ballot trail, and the memory card. And I assume there's some way to hack this, but at least not in the same way as that you've talked about. I have noticed that, and it really bugs me, in talking, you know, voters, even longtime voters who come to the polls often think that they're a registered Democrat. They don't understand the voting process or the voter registration process. And we have a system where the county clerks are elected as a party official. Our county clerk is a Republican. Mm-hmm. And one time we had, at one polling place where I was working on campus, there were challenges to voters by poll watchers for a Republican candidate. And I said, what basis are you making this challenge on? They said, well, we have a list of addresses. I said, where'd you get it from? And they handed me a phone to talk to a Republican operative, and guess who it was? It was the county clerk.
Oh, geez. That's,
you know,
amazing.
And here I'm supposed to make a decision based on, and the county clerk is supporting the Republican candidate. It was like, what hat are you wearing, Mr. County Clerk?
Right, right.
It really bothered me. And it also, in terms of voter registration, it's rather subtle, because people who do not move around, who own their own homes, who are established in their professions or retired, don't move very much. People who are younger, who have less income, move more. And
right.
They don't know. There isn't a lot of publicity about what do you do when you move? What do you, people think that there's some big brother in the sky who knows that they've moved and will change their registration for them. It happens over and over and over again, but I see this. We don't do enough to educate people on how to do this. You might think that citizens should know this, but it's not something that we do every day. And when we move, we're just not paying a lot of attention. And there's another thing I want to say, this whole thing about right to life and protecting babies. Somebody needs to point out to all of us that 50 to 75% of fertilized eggs naturally do not make it. They do not make it. There are problems with our reproductive system. It's probably a good thing that bad mutations get weeded out. Because we have better pregnancy tests and women have better idea whether they've gotten pregnant or not, we're beginning to realize how often we don't actually continue with the fertilized egg going anywhere.
Okay,
caller, I want to thank you very much.
Thanks.
We do have to wrap up soon. Yeah, Mark, very brief so I can try to get one last caller on.
She's talking about optical scanners, which are computerized machines that count paper ballots. Those are different from the kind of touchscreen machines I was talking about, but they nevertheless are just as easily hacked. They are made by the same companies that make the touchscreen machines, and all four of those companies are dominated by the Republican Party. And finally, in a few dozen cases that we know of, optical scanners have been shown to yield fraudulent results. So
let's go to our last caller if we can, then, just for a very brief comment. Line 2, Eggar County, just a few seconds. Do you have anything you want to ask?
Yes, I'd like to say that Obama spoke in Terre Haute, Indiana yesterday, and there are three TV stations in Terre Haute, Indiana, two of them owned by the same company, and none of them had on-air reporting of his speech in its entirety. You could only get it online on the CBS outlet.
Yeah.
And I think this media indifference contributes to what you're speaking about.
Yeah, well, I think it's something a bit more aggressive than indifference. But, you know, the last two calls, Bob, both mentioned examples of you know, basically the foxes guarding the chicken coop. You got a county clerk who was a party operative in this one place in Illinois, but, you know, Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State in Ohio, was also the co-chair of Bush Cheney's campaign in that state. The same with Catherine Harris in Florida in 2000. The same with Jan Brewer in Arizona in 2004. Likewise, we have, since the media has been deregulated, so to speak, we've had our whole system of communication, our whole media system, which is, of course, vital to the health of a democracy, largely controlled by a kind of minoritarian interest. What we're talking about here basically throughout this hour is the dire need for us to reclaim something of our actual democratic traditions and to realize democracy, you know, both within our media system and this is closely related, through our election system, which
well, Mark
at the moment
Miller, on that note,
democratic.
I must tell you that you may hear the band tuning up in the background. That's when they want to kick me out of the studio.
Okay.
So I want to thank you so much for joining us the last hour.
All right, thank you.
Our guest has been Mark Crispin Miller, author and editor of the new book, Loser Take All, professor at NYU. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. I want to thank Andrew Boyle for being the producer. I'll be back in 167 hours. Till then, everyone, have a great week. Goodbye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. ¶¶
WILL's Daniel Pounder says partly sunny today for Champaign-Urbana and the area. The high 75, the wind from the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with showers and thunderstorms arriving, the low 57 degrees. Cloudy with periods of rain and thunderstorms tomorrow, the high 71. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with the chance of thunderstorms during the evening, the low around 50 degrees. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.